Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Of all the money that e'er I spent it in good company. And of all the harm that e'er I've done, alas, it was to none but me. For all I've done, for want of
wealth. In some ways, that's like the most Irish song ever, but it's ordinarily a song that we would play maybe at the end of an episode. It's called The Parting Glass, for those of you who don't know. We're playing it at the beginning because some partings are happening here. We're talking to Don Winslow, one of the great crime writers of his generation. He has written a trilogy of novels that represent, according to him, and over the objections of pretty much everybody, his final works of this kind. Don Winslow is here, and we should also say there's an Irish protagonist, Danny Ryan. He's here in the studio with me today, Don Winslow. City in Ruins has just came out yesterday. It's the final book of the Danny Ryan trilogy. First of all, welcome to Hartford.
Thanks. Nice to be here, always.
I have this feeling when I read these books that you wrote them just for me. I mean, they're Irish protagonist. They are based on the kind of Greco-Roman sources that I wound up, that I grew up reading, the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid. And there's occasional references to the Boston baseball team. I mean, we did a whole episode about Ted Williams where I talked about him in terms of Achilles. See, wow. Ted Williams is like Achilles, but he plays for Troy. but he's got the Achilles personality.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So I mean, just begin here. I just want to say it's odd that you're talking about stopping when you are writing so incredibly well. I mean, say a little bit about that. I mean, you must be aware of this too, that you are kind of at the height of your powers right now.
Well, I want to stop while I'm writing well.
Yeah, consider the alternative.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, listen, I think, you know, we could talk about the retirement if you want and the reasons for it. I don't maybe want to get overtly political with you, but that's part of the reason that I'm retiring is to focus on other things. But also, you know, Colin, I've had such a great career, so much better than I ever imagined it would be. I'm so grateful for it, and I don't want to push that, you know? I think there are times when a time comes when I think you need to exit the stage graciously and make room for other people.
We will get overtly political towards the end of the show. But okay. But yeah, I mean, in this new book, City of Ruins, one of the things that I'm really noticing, and because it dropped yesterday, I'm not all the way through it. I read the first two books. I think that's kind of ideal, too, because first of all, I'm in no danger of spoiling anything for you.
Well, but here's how it ends.
No. No, but I'm noticing the incredible economy of your writing right now. We meet a character named Stavros. He is the chapter that introduces him is about, I would be surprised if it's more than 700 words long. And in that moment, in him stirring some coffee, in him lying but not really lying to his wife about whether he put sugar in his coffee because he's a diabetic. In just a few things, we know so much about him at the end of that 650, 700 words. And I know you spent a long time writing these books from the time that they start. Mm-hmm. It feels like you spent a lot of time boiling away fat, and you've really just got some leanness here.
Yeah. Well, first, thank you very much. I mean, that's what I've been trying to do, and I think as I've progressed in this career, I've tried to become more economical with words. I've tried to make fewer words do more work, one thing I kind of say to myself about words is it's like people in your apartment, you know. There's no free ride. You either have to pay rent or at least do the dishes, you know, if you're going to sleep on the couch. And so, yeah, thank you very much. I work really hard at that.
Yeah, I mean, Faulkner said, murder your darlings. And then there's no evidence that he ever murdered
a single darling. Yeah.
But you clearly, yeah, you have done that. I want to talk a little bit about Danny as well. He starts out as kind of a pretty low-level hoodlum in the Rhode Island Irish Mafia, which is in itself kind of fading before our eyes. And the story is very much of a man who's been underestimated, maybe by even himself. What he sees as his possibilities in that very first book, in those very first few pages, is pretty limited. By the beginning of this book, he's a Las Vegas kingpin. I don't know. You've been living with Danny for a long time. Maybe, is he Don Winslow a little bit? Is he? Who is he?
It's remarkable how little self-awareness a person can have, Colin. You know, I grew up in Rhode Island. I left when I was 17. And I wandered the world, you know, for close to 40 years, trying to find a little success, a little stability, as I say in the book about Danny, a place to put my feet. You know, I didn't make that connection until I was deep into writing the third book. And then it finally occurred to me, you know, there are some parallels between Danny and me.
Do you want to say what they are?
Listen, he flees Rhode Island as a refugee, as a fugitive. Yep. I didn't flee as a fugitive, but there was nothing for me there in those days. You know, don't come from money. Wanted to be a writer. Nobody stamps your passport to do that, you know. Failed at being a writer for a long time. And was all over the place, you know, in Africa and China and England. Being a low-level PI in Times Square in Hell's Kitchen. Being a higher-level PI in California. Leading photographic safaris in Kenya, right? All trying to be a writer and not getting it done. And so I know that Danny feeling. And at the same time, you know, I wasn't supporting an elderly father, but I was supporting a baby and a wife. Mm-hmm. The three of us lived in hotels for 3 years while I was moving around California doing various cases. So I started to see those parallels.
I mean, one of the things that stands out in that story, and I'm aware of what you just said, but, you know, you're not one of these people who went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop and then,
right.
I mean, you actually went out and lived and had some experiences and maybe figured out.
I've never had a writing class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the things I've been thinking about with your work and with crime fiction in general is how much of it is about the second law of thermodynamics. And whether you can bargain with it, right? The order tends to devolve into chaos.
Yeah.
You know, we were both talking before airtime here about Adrian McKinty, the also a crime fiction writer from Northern Ireland initially. He's got a detective named Sean Duffy who talks about that sometimes, that he feels like he's the bulwark in between his people and chaos. Mm-hmm. Danny is in a very different position, but I think he's the same guy in a way. He lives inside the chaos, but nonetheless, he is trying to prevent spillover at all times. You know, say a little bit about how you see that. He lives in the world of crime, but he wants it to sit in a certain place and not go other places.
Yeah, you know, Danny's is based on Aeneas, you know, first in the Iliad and then in the Aeneid. And the Aeneid always talks about or always refers to him as devout. Which wasn't really going to work for me, although he, you know, he grew up Catholic and has, you know, all of that that comes with that.
Pius Aeneas. Well, that's the Latin word, P-I-U-S.
Yeah, exactly.
Pius
Aeneas. So I think that Danny, you know, and you mentioned this earlier, and I think quite correctly, his goals initially are very modest. Mm-hmm. He just wants a little stability to raise his wife and his kid. That is absolutely destroyed by the end of book one. And then he's just out there in the world with a few of his followers and what's left of his family. And again, what he's trying to do is just get a little stability to keep the chaos out of his life. And yet he makes, I think, at times some really bad choices that reintroduce the chaos. And I think it's arguable whether those are forced on him or whether maybe he had other options and chose those things.
Yeah, I mean, he is all the way through this third book kind of haunted by those choices and those mm-hmm. memories. He thinks about people that he's seen killed, and he thinks about people that he's killed. Mm-hmm. He thinks about the things that he's done that he regrets. Yeah, and it does occur to me that the template for a lot of this stuff was written by another mutual friend of ours, W.B. Yeats. Mm-hmm. You know, he says things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, the blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all convictions, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. That's like crime novels.
Absolutely. It's so funny, Colin. I just finished directing an evening of three Irish one-act plays, including one by Yeats. So.
Hmm. Where's that come? Was that at the...
In California, in San Diego, okay. Yeah.
Bring it to the Irish Rep in New York.
And I'll see it. That'd be great. And then I think about Danny sometimes in reference to another Yeats poem, I Shall Arise Now and Go to Innisfree. You know, where he's really looking for some peace and some tranquility that eludes him.
Not a lot of B-Loud glades in Las Vegas.
Not a lot of B-Loud glades, although I guess if you have the money, you know, build one.
As it turns out, you could build anything in Las Vegas. Very much the message of the new book. Yeah, it's interesting because we talked a while back at the Twain House. And at the time, the first book, it was out. And I kind of had my classics nerd antennae up reading that book. But I've noticed one of the things I like about what's happening now is I'm missing things. Like I suddenly realized last night that in the second book, I had seen the story of Clytemnestra, who was murdered by her son Orestes to revenge the murder of Orestes' father, Agamemnon, mm-hmm. and that happens in the second book.
Yeah.
I completely had whiffed
Is
on
that. Right?
Yeah, I just...
Yeah, good for you, man.
Well, I think it means, you know, you're not mapping your stuff onto this stuff. You're taking these ideas and transposing them, but making them very much your own.
Thank you. I mean, that's what I was trying to do. Look, if you look at the plot of the Oresteia,
mm-hmm.
If you filmed it in black and white and put a trumpet behind it, you have a noir movie, and I couldn't resist it. And it also, you know, in book three, it continues. I don't know if you're that far into it, but, you know, the third play in the Oresteia is the first trial scene in Western literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that was irresistible to me to come and then do the trial, you know.
One of the great characters in the third book is a woman who's a prosecutor, who's a former nun. I'm really enjoying her quite a bit. And there's also one of those quick Winslow exchanges between her and a guy who's trying to kind of lean on her to avoid a subpoena for some mobster. And he gets her to kind of agree to that. And he goes, you know, I mean, this has got to hold up. And she goes, would a nun lie? And he goes, they do in Sound of Music. She goes, I can't sing and I can't fly either. I'm thinking, oh, man, you must have pushed back from the typewriter when you wrote that. And went, okay, that's going to stay in there.
I had a small moment of self-congratulation.
I think you're entitled.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think another thing that's happening in these books, and it's a recurrent theme in a lot of culture and a lot of culture these days, is the person attempting to find some thread of morality inside a profoundly immoral system. I mean, we see that a little bit with Tony Soprano, mm-hmm. although not with much luck in Tony's part. We saw it with Walter White in Breaking Bad. Danny is very much that guy.
Yeah.
He's essentially born into a very immoral system where blood vengeance is just kind of priced in to affairs, but he's looking for morality in there. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, I was writing a book called The Power of the Dog quite a few years ago now about the Mexican drug cartels, and I was in the tall grass, man. I was completely lost. I had five characters running around over 40 years, and I had 2,000 page manuscript that was a mess. And I am answering your question. And I couldn't figure that book out until I sat back and asked, what does each character want in his or her core? And I think I hit upon what for me is the central question of crime fiction, which is exactly what you were saying. It's the question, how do you attempt to live decently in an indecent world? And I think since Dog, Power of the Dog, that has been at the center of my writing in crime fiction. I think every character is looking for that, or most of the characters are looking for that. And certainly Danny is. I think he has that Catholic morality in the same sense, you know, we talked about the pious Aeneas earlier, always trying to find that way to live decently. And I think in book three, in City and Ruins, he thinks he's found it. And then the past comes up.
Yeah.
And he has to deal with it in immoral ways.
Right. You can see that second law of thermodynamics mm-hmm. at work. He thinks he's got stability.
Yeah.
And it's just leaking until it bursts out.
Right. And he can't outrun it. You know, and there's an old saying in surfing that is absolutely true. You can't outrun a wave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the only way you can deal with it is to turn and face it and dive into it. And for good or ill, that's what Danny does.
You know, you've had work turned into movies before. It looks like at some point in the fairly near future, I could just spend 2 or 3 weeks watching Don Winslow adaptations on various platforms. A lot of things are happening.
Yeah.
But including the idea of this being adapted, and I guess mm-hmm. with Austin Butler
yeah.
now being attached to the project mm-hmm. As Danny Ryan. I'm the millionth person, I'm sure, to make this joke or whatever. But the minute I read that, I thought, well, in the second book, City of Dreams, these two kind of knuckleheaded gangster guys, these subordinates of Danny's, known as the Altar Boys,
yeah.
they're on a movie set for a movie I think called Providence.
Yeah.
And they're you know, trying to be, they're supposedly authenticity consultants. Of
right.
course, they can't live within that particular role. They mess everything up. But I'm just wondering if you're starting to already picture having some version of Kevin and Sean? Is this Sean?
Yeah, Kevin and Sean. Yeah.
Yeah. On set saying, oh, no, you got to call it a cabinet. It's not a milkshake.
Yeah.
You know, no, it's a bubbler, not a water fountain. I mean,
I'm really hoping they go for that, you know, because I wrote those sequences probably 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When I was still failing at writing this project. But it's always stayed in because I don't know, I was so amused by the idea of some of these classic Rhode Island punks getting to the craft services table on a set.
Mm-hmm.
Free food. I mean, they're like raccoons. They're never going to leave, right?
Yes, food. Free food is an interesting kind of through line here for some of these characters, because a lot of them become wealthy in ill-gotten ways, and then some of the ill-gotten money is invested somewhat more legitimately. But there's another character, his name is, I believe, Bernie Hughes, mm-hmm. who's an accountant, who, you know, at some point must be just insanely rich, but has made some of his life choices based on the free breakfasts at the Residence Inn
Absolutely.
Or wherever the hell he's staying.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, let's be honest. Free food tastes better.
Yeah.
It just does, you know. But yeah, I did a short story, actually, about a guy named Free Billy who's figured out how to live for free in San Diego by going to hotels that serve breakfast and pretending he's a guest and going to art openings and film shoots and sneaking in with the extras, you know, to get fed. So,
Is that one of the ones that Harris did on Audible?
Ed Harris read that story.
I might have listened to it, yeah.
And I would love to hear it. Apparently, there's any number of outtakes of him just cracking up, laughing, and he can't get through it.
But I think there's also, one of the things that I see in all that, too, is, and it's there in Danny, it's in all these characters, and I think it's in us, all of us, too. We're a little bit arrested at some earlier point of our lives, no matter how much our life changes.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was mentioning to my son the other day that I bring back bottles, because it's like 10 cents, you know, on the bottle. They raised it up, and I put it in the, it's like a slot machine, but in reverse. You put it in the, and you just get money back, you know. Mm. You put it in this little hole, little piece of tape comes out. And he goes, you know, my son says, there's a lot of people who wouldn't do that just because of the associations. I said, like, I'm a meth head or something? And he goes, well, yeah, kind of.
Oh, okay,
you know,
yeah.
But I'm thinking, and he's also thinking, I could tell, you don't need the 10 cents. You don't need the $1.70 that the machine spits out. And I'm thinking, no, I want the $1.70. And it's true. I don't need it, but I'm still. But there was a time when I needed it.
Oh, yeah.
There was a time when you needed that.
Oh, yeah.
There's a time when Bernie needed a free breakfast.
Right.
I don't think we ever quite live that down.
We never get over that, you know? I mean, I do okay now, right?
Yeah.
But for a long time, I didn't. And that memory is just, it's baked in, you know? Yeah, I want the $170. But what I was chortling about while you were telling that story is the great Seinfeld episode where Kramer and Newman try to drive the truck full of cans and bottles to Michigan because it's an extra 5 cents. And they're trying to figure out the economy of it and stuff.
Yeah, everybody's hustling.
We're all the same cat, as Lenny Bruce said many years ago.
All right, on that beautiful note, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with more of Don Winslow after this.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Let there be you, let there be me, let there be oysters under the sea, let there be wind and occasional rain, chili con carne and sparkling champagne, let there be birds to sing in the trees, someone to bless me whenever I sneeze, let there be cuckoos, a lark and a dove, but first of all, please...
Aw, Sammy. So, I wanted to open with that song because we need to talk about Vegas.
Yeah.
The parts of all three of these books have Vegas in them, but this third book is the Vegas-iest ever. And I was... You really had to go to school... on Vegas. You can't, first of all, it's a hard thing to write about because it's a place that people visit and you rarely get to know the people who live there. But you needed to learn a lot about Vegas and so-called old Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. See, first of all, how did you do that? How did you immerse yourself?
I think any crime writer roughly of my generation, if we're going to write American crime history in our fiction, we need to be conversant with Vegas. It's just part of it, you know. No matter where you're writing about, if you're writing about the mob, Vegas is going to come into it at some point. So I've always kind of followed it, but for this, I mean, it was sort of two streams. One was, as you referred to, old Vegas. So I spent a lot of time there, and I have good connections there, and they connected me with other connections. So I, you know, sat around the table with some of the little guys. And they told me stories. Where I really had an issue was learning the business. Mm-hmm. Not so much the gambling business, because my grandmother's a professional gambler who taught me how to shoot dice and play poker and stuff when I was a child. But the mega hotel business, you know, because I was interested in writing about this era where the mob was fading out or almost completely faded out of Vegas and corporate America, big money America was taking over. But there was still, you know, sort of a Venn diagram of that where they coexisted inside a certain slice. So I had to read a lot of books, business books, about the mega hotels and how they were built and what the funding was like and how that transition happened.
I should have said, coming out of the break, we're talking to Don Winslow. He is, of course, one of the great crime writers of his generation. He is his third book of his trilogy. The Danny Ryan trilogy is out now, and he is on tour. I'll mention some of your stops a little bit later, just in case people want to seek you out in somewhere else in New England. But yeah, I mean, well, first of all, let's talk about the business part of it, because one of the things you have to do plausibly in this third book. So here's Danny Ryan, mm-hmm. who, when we first meet him, you know, his highest hopes are probably that he's going to knock over some trucks that have some really good stuff in them, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah. That's yeah, like, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
maybe finish ahead at the end of the year by $5,000 or something. Now he is a mogul. He's a hotel and casino mogul. And he's a visionary. I mean, here's Danny, who's like, you know, his squeeze can't even get him to read The Great Gatsby. I'm not sure Jay Gatsby would have read The Great Gatsby either, but,
right.
you know, he's not book smart. But we see him figure stuff out that, like, Steve Wynn figured out and a couple right. of other people, but not too much. And I don't know, you had to figure that out. Can you say a little bit about, did you at some point go, you know, I could have just been running casinos and hotels here, you know, save myself a lot of trouble with this writing stuff.
The third book was by far the hardest book to write for yeah. a lot of reasons, and one of them is that, mm. right? I think you mentioned earlier in the interview, you know, that Danny constantly underestimates himself.
Mm.
And I think that's really true. And when he comes to Vegas and he takes some, you know, a score, a big score that he made, and he has some money and he decides to invest it and stay there, again, in this search for stability, I think he starts seeing things in himself that he never realized were there. Now, in coming up with his hotel dream, Il Sogno, which is dream in Italian, I had to start imagining, what would I want
mm-hmm.
if I, God forbid, were to be in the casino business and, you know, and launch a mega hotel, or what kind of casino? Because I don't gamble. It bores the hell out of me. I don't drink. There's not a lot for me to do in casinos. But what would I like if I went? You know, what would I like to see? What kind of experience would I like to have? And is it doable? And that's the way I approached it.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of it is humanism. Mm-hmm. One of the things that Danny does is to treat people decently,
mm-hmm.
From the chambermaids on up.
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes that if he does that, and if he does it in a certain semi-manipulative way, he'll get a certain kind of result. So that's something that I could imagine an author figuring out.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the business of this seems very realistically rendered. So, but I guess we're back to conversations you had.
And, yeah. Yeah, conversations and then reading business books,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is not my métier. You know, it's not normally where I'd go, but you go where you need to go in terms of the research. But then I also talked to business people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and said, hey, is this realistic? Could this happen? And I talked to people in Las Vegas, you know, how could a guy with a gangster reputation be allowed to do this,
mm-hmm.
you know, because, I mean, Steve Wynn was accused of having mob ties, which he is, you know, denied, I think, quite effectively. So, you know, it could happen. And what I was more concerned about, really, Colin, was would my readers make that big leap with me?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted something very different for Danny in the third book than what we'd seen in the first two.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to just repeat myself. I wanted something, you know, drastically different in his life, and am hoping that the readers will take that leap with me. It's funny, you know, when I was looking, because I always look at better writers, you know, to teach me things. And for this series, you know, one of the things I looked at, in addition to the classics, was John Updike's Rabbit series. You know, where he goes through a series of changes, not as drastic as maybe Danny does, but, you know, how do you do that, and how do you make it effective?
Can I tell you something about Steve Wynn?
Yeah.
Do you know what his favorite musical is?
I have no clue.
The Music Man. Now, think about that.
Mm.
And he actually can. I used to work at a different radio station. He was trying to bring a casino to Hartford, and he came, and he knew that I was a skeptic and an opponent, and he was brought in there. And I had heard this thing about him. And so as he walked into our studio, I had the Trouble in River City thing playing. And he just started doing the words.
Is that right?
Yeah, he just started doing the words. He knew that whole rap of Trouble in River City. But think about that. Think about who Harold Hill is.
Sure. Yeah.
and I mean, that's a sort of a Don Winslow detail. It's from real life. But that's one of the ways that you get us to know your characters. It's the little perfect detail.
Yeah.
And those exist in real life, too.
They do, you know, and I think that comes back to what we discussed earlier about doing more with fewer words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get the little details like the cookies, you know, with Stavros and other little things, and I think they're very human, and it allows the reader, you know, inside.
I mean, that little exchange that I talked about before, the great moment, I think, is, so he's a diabetic. He has surreptitiously stirred a little sugar into his coffee. He has a certain way he wants to stir the sugar, too,
mm-hmm.
not overstir it, all this stuff. And his wife says to him, did you put sugar in your coffee? And he says, I'm a diabetic. And you say, because he doesn't lie to his wife. I thought, oh, that's the universe right there.
I've been married for 39 years.
And I think also what we see in this book, what we see in all of your books, and what is sort of a fundamental human truth too, is everybody's trying to address some kind of chasm in their own lives. The people who build things, the people who make things, the people who invent and dream. You know, like there's a guy who, the kind of rival casino mm-hmm. hotel mogul, is this guy, and he's got really bad skin, and he's another guy who's been underestimated as a kid, mm-hmm. and his father didn't think much of him. And there's always that idea, right? I have this scratch. I have this dent. And here's what I'm going to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Say a little bit about how you see that.
Well, I think there's a line in the book, maybe, about, you know, you never recover from high school, either for good or for ill. You know, I think when you tell people, as I did as a kid, that you're going to be a writer, when you're a little kid, you get these sort of indulgent looks from the adults.
Mm-hmm.
But you can read that look that says, no, you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Later on in high school, you know, I was pretty much told I was mediocre. And I think that you carry that stuff with you, and maybe you spend your life addressing that particular dent as you referred to it, you know. You know, you're always told as a kid, you know, by the guidance counselors, right? Well, you better have a backup plan, you know, and it's clear from the look in their eyes that they believe that Plan B is going to be Plan A.
You probably need Plan C, too.
Yeah, right. I mean, I had Plan Z, you know, eventually. But for me, I mean, I think that, yeah, that certainly existed, and to a certain extent probably still exists.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is not a particularly novel insight, but in some ways the worst thing that can happen to you is that you're the captain and the homecoming king and stuff like that in high school, right? Because it's probably going to go downhill from there.
Right.
And the other thing that happens, I used to work in a place where there was a guy, I hope he doesn't recognize himself in this story, he dressed kind of oddly. I mean, he had like red shirts and white ties and, you know, this kind of, and we used to remark behind his back about it. And this woman said to me, he probably got laid a lot in high school and he dressed like that. And he doesn't know that it's like 30 years down the line. And it doesn't really make sense anymore. And there's a lot of truth, I think, there. You know, being the king when you're 17 or 18, not good for you, right?
I don't think so, you know. And again, I hope people don't recognize themselves, but I know people for whom high school was the peak of their lives. And you think, well, you're 17 or 18 years old. There's a lot of life left to be looking back on those 4 years as being the best, you know?
So just a couple of minutes left in this segment, and you mentioned your grandmother teaching you to gamble. My grandmother, Alma Cotton, had in her apartment, where ordinarily a Catholic, for example, might have a votive statue, she had a statue of Ted Williams. and she... I mean, there's some Red Sox and theology stuff that's in this book, but she really did think of him that way, that there were evil forces in the world. Most of them wore pinstripes. There were evil forces in the world, and there was one person who could stand up to them, you know? And I do think that this is something that non-New Englanders have a hard time understanding.
Yeah.
The degree to which this is not entirely about baseball. There's something else going on there.
It's about suffering. I think it's about the nobility of suffering. And I think there's a little Catholic theology that goes into that, you know, that for so many years, being a Red Sox fan was a penance. A few years ago, my publisher arranged for me to throw out the first pitch at Yankee Stadium, and which I did, which was terrifying, by the way. And I came back. My mom was still alive, and I came back up to Rhode Island because they give you a Yankees jersey. She was appalled.
Oh, yes. Unclean.
And she said to me, I mean, in total seriousness, you're not a Yankees fan now, as if she was asking, you know, you haven't turned to Satanism, have you? You know, and I had to reassure.
Well, she's right. They are the same thing, but continue.
But when they finally won the World Series, I was in California on my knees in front of the TV set with my mother's number dialed in Rhode Island, waiting to hit send for that final out. And when I did and reached her, she was sobbing.
It's weird, too, because 86 is mentioned in this book.
Yeah.
Well, see, I had a very different reaction as a lifelong Red Sox fan.
Tell me.
First of all, I should tell you that when I wasn't, I didn't have a football team for a long time when I was a teenager.
All right.
And I just happened to see the Green Bay Packers play. They weren't any good anymore, and they had a guy, Dan Devine, as their coach. Mm-hmm. And the running back got pushed out of bounds and broke Dan Devine's leg, and he coached the rest of the season in a wheelchair.
I remember that.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, I recognize this.
That's
I'm a Red
guy.
Sox fan. Yeah. I'm a Packers fan now, if that's what it's going to be like. But I think also, you say Catholic, I think also New England Protestantism, if you think about what Calvinism was.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's a system where you cannot condition your salvation.
Right.
You have no power.
Right.
Whether you're good or a reprobate, it doesn't make any difference. God is making these very arbitrary decisions about you.
You're one of the select or you're not.
Yeah, you can't do anything about it. That's what's...
The ball's going to roll through his legs.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, thinking that feels very much like the sense of powerlessness that we knew for most of our lives, not, you know.
Colin, I still can picture that, and it hurts, as my New Orleans grandmother would have said. It hurts. It just hurts.
See, I had my reaction to that was, as it appeared that they were going to win the World Series in 86, I thought, well, what will I had this real notion of what will I yearn for? My whole life has been about this kind of yearning. It's like in Chariots of Fire when Abrams wins the gold medal, and he has that moment of
now what?
Now what? Yeah.
Yeah.
I had that. I was almost a little alarmed. Wow. I had nothing to worry about, as it turned out.
No, nothing.
All right. We're going to I'm going to stop babbling. I'm going to let Don Winslow talk, because that's the idea.
Let me babble.
Yeah, we'll let Don Winslow babble. We'll take a little break. We'll come right back.
Okay.
We are back. The technical producer of today's show is Kat Pastor. The producer of today's show is the senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show, Lily Tyson. Our guest today is Don Winslow. He's here in studio with us as part of his tour of New England on behalf of these three books, but particularly the newest one, City in Ruins. If you want to catch up with Don Winslow, you can do so Wednesday, April 3rd in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and then Westerly, Rhode Island on the 4th on Thursday. But they got rid of that. They had that great bookstore in Westerly. It was like part of an old train
station. Savoy.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the new version of it.
Oh, they do have a new version? I'm so happy.
Yeah.
And then in Cambridge on Friday, Barrington, Rhode Island on Saturday the 20th, and Wakefield, Rhode Island on the 21st. You can find Don Winslow if you try. That would be my feeling. So we should talk a little bit. We talked about this a little bit at the Twain House, but one of the reasons that you are going to, we all believe temporarily, but you believe permanently, stop writing crime fiction, is that you have become very politically active.
Yeah.
And I think it's fair to say, correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the reasons you're politically active in the way that you are is that you feel as though some of your facility with words, with imagery, with dialogue, with... I'll stop there. Might make you a good message bearer. I mean, there's sort of a way when you watch politics sometimes, you watch candidates sometimes, it's a little bit like, you know, Casey Stengel said about the Mets, can't nobody play this game? Sometimes you watch and you think, you're a candidate, and that's what you figured out to do?
Yeah. Listen, I think what we need to do, and I've been doing it now for about 5 or 6 years, is try to talk in plain, tough language and tell the story.
Mm.
You know, that's what I do. That's what I do for a living. That's where my skills are. I'm not a politician. And I'm not interested in being polite, and I'm not interested in, you know, in any of that. I'm tired, and I've said this before, of us bringing spoons to a knife fight, you know? And so what I try to do on social media, because you fight the battle where the battle is, right, is to talk in plain, tough language to people.
Yeah, I teach a seminar. This is probably the last time I'm doing that, but on contemporary political journalism. I teach it in real time, and I was teaching it yesterday. Meets on Tuesdays. And I was saying to them that I still struggle with the question of whether Donald Trump is an idiot or a savant. And, of course, he might be both.
Both, yeah.
Yeah. There's, you know, I mean, for example, he recently used the term bloodbath. But his syntax is so jumbled that it could have applied to the condition of the auto industry should he not be reelected. Or it could apply to a much more graphic and visceral kind of bloodbath. But it's very difficult to pin that down. It's like nailing quicksilver to the wall, partly because the way that he talks almost makes accountability impossible at times. And I think, yeah, go ahead.
Well, because he's incoherent in that way. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, then.
But is he incoherent like a fox is what I'm asking.
I think he's a deeply stupid man. I certainly know he's a deeply ignorant man.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
The submarine has yet to be invented that could plumb the depths of Donald Trump's ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I think he has a certain kind of feral cunning, like a rodent. And it's had its effect.
I mean, there he has created, and it's one of the reasons that the job that you're taking on is a big one. He's created this odd kind of solipsistic universe where it's like a paranoid schizophrenic. Supposedly, once you grant their initial premise, everything else makes sense.
Yeah.
And there's sort of a way of that, right? That there's this, if you grant the initial premise that Donald Trump is the light and the truth, then everything else that he says makes sense simply because he's set up a system in which criticism is immediately discounted.
Sure, and the cognitive dissonance that arises from that is ferocious. But we need to keep saying it. The guy's a fake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a Trump store opened at a town near us in California. And if my wife hadn't been with me that day, I wanted to go into that store and say, can I buy some steaks? Oh, no, I guess not. Can I buy some wine? Oh, no. How about, can I sign up for college courses? Okay. Well, is there a special on treason this week? You know?
Thank you, Mrs. Winslow, for not letting him do that.
The guy is a total fraud, you know? And that might be the best thing we can say about him. And speaking in plain language, he's a traitor. Can we just speak plainly, the guy tried to overthrow the government of the United States. He staged a coup. He's a traitor. And now he's the Republican nominee for president. And of course, all the Republican Party ever does anymore is kneel on the ground and throw dirt over itself. They almost can't find enough ways to humiliate themselves.
Well, I think the other thing is, and I'm trying to figure out right now to what degree my profession has some complicity in this, is that there are just so many stories coming out all the time. I mean, I was just noticing over the course of about 48 hours in the New York Times, there was an opinion piece explaining why Trump is Al Capone, that he's modeling himself on Al Capone. He's a gangster.
Well, he has more indictments than Al Capone. I looked it up.
Well, there are a lot of laws written after Al Capone, so you could get people more easily for, you know, tax fraud and stuff like that, but there was another story about how he's kind of this Christ slash David figure to the, you know, evangelicals who worship him, and then he's a stock. You can watch him on the stock exchange. And I'm thinking, well, if there are so many different motifs for looking at him, so many different tropes for understanding this guy, then there isn't one, you know?
Yeah.
And I think
that's
some of the problem, too. There, if we just had, hey, look, he's kind of a, he's a bum, and he kind of, he's been stiffing people his entire life. And what, it just isn't ever that simple.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between Al Capone and Donald Trump is that Al Capone would pick up a dinner check every once in a while.
So I also wonder, though, I mean, so I think being a novelist is hard, and it's, you know, you got to drag yourself out to the keyboard every single day and make something happen. But part of being a novelist is you ultimately do get to make some decisions about how things come out.
Right.
And you're entering a very different world. You're nodding, so I'm thinking of something to
Sorry,
say about
that's not useful on radio, is it, for me to nod? Well, it is very different. You know, in my other life as a novelist, people will eventually do what I want them to do or say what I want them to say, or I delete them. You know, that's not possible either at home or in the political world. So it's a very different kind of dynamic. I think we're all concerned. We're all anxious for good reasons. There is a road to victory for this guy, you know, which I think would be, I think it'd be a wound to our body politic from which we will never recover.
Yeah, I also think about in your these last three books, one of the characters who maybe maps most closely to the Greco-Roman origins, right down to the name, is Cassie.
Yeah.
Cassie is Cassandra. Cassandra, we did a whole show about Cassandras, people who try to warn us about things. And maybe you could say a little bit about that, too, because, of course, the tragedy of Cassandra and the reason she becomes kind of a template for warners, admonishers, is that she is unlistened to.
Yeah, no one ever listened to her.
Yeah.
Yeah, including Danny, right? In the first book, she's trying to tell him, don't do this. Don't bring in the Trojan horse of heroin, regardless of how tempting it is. Listen, I called Donald Trump a fascist in 2015, and everybody told me I was a fantasist and, you know, I was overreacting and it was ridiculous. And I was also, frankly, one of the few people who said he could win in 2016. I'm very unhappy to have been proven right on both those points. I hope now that people are listening to what this guy is saying. He's going to be a dictator for a day? Baloney. No one's a dictator for a day. He's going to trigger, you know, he talks about a bloodbath. I mean, everything he's saying, you know, it's an old cliche. If people tell you who they are, listen to them. So listen. And if you're on the fence, by the way, as long as I'm preaching, Colin, I just cut you off there. If you're on the fence, get off the fence, because that fence is going to become your prison.
So how far are you willing to take this? Are you going to be wandering around swing states? You're going to be walking around Michigan talking to people? And
yeah, well, no, not physically wandering around. But, you know, in the last campaign, we directed two videos very specifically at Pennsylvania, which Mr. Springsteen helped us out with, and in Michigan, which Jeff Daniels, great actor, great guy, helped us out with. We very much targeted Georgia during the Senate runoff election. So, no, I doubt that I'll be hoofing it around Michigan and Pennsylvania, but I think it'd be more effective targeting important swing states with what I hope and believe will be effective videos. It boggles my mind, Colin, that our videos have gotten over 300 million views. And those are crazy numbers, but it shows that we're doing something.
Oh, the search is always for the persuadable person as opposed to the already persuaded person.
I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah?
Yeah, we certainly direct some of it toward the persuadable person, and in particularly in Michigan, we very much directed our words and our images at that male Trump voter to give him an excuse not to do that. But I think that there's a lot of benefit also into firing up the base, you know, that might be, you know, thinking, oh, I'll sit this one out, and or saying you can't afford to sit this one out.
All right, so we're almost out of time here. When you first arrived, Lily Tyson gave you some coffee.
She did. God bless Lily Tyson.
I had her put sodium pentothal in that coffee. So are you absolutely certain that you're not going to write another novel?
Yes.
He said it. All right. It's not the answer we wanted, but it's the answer we got. Don Winslow, it's such a privilege to have you here today. The new book is City in Ruins, but you really have to read all three of the Danny Ryan trilogy. It's going to stand as a real crime fiction writing masterpiece. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks. I had a really great time. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah. All right.
Fun talking with you.
Well, you know where we live now.
I do. I'll be back.
Come by anytime.
All right.
All right. We're going to say goodbye to the rest of you. Thanks so much for listening today. We thought we would go out with a particular song.
Pencils come from Pennsylvania, vests from West Virginia, and tents from Tennessee. They know mink where they grow mink in Wyoming, a camp chair in New Hampshire, that's for me. And minnows come from Minnesota, coats come from Dakota, but why should you be blue? For you come from Rhode Island, and little old Rhode Island is famous for